Chapter 38. Goldfish Point, La Jolla, California. Coffee in hand, Sam and Remy walked into the workroom at 8 a.m. to find Selma, Pete, and Wendy standing before a 6-foot-wide map of the Indian Ocean tacked to the wall with blue painter's tape. 6 hours earlier, at Pete and Wendy's urging, Sam and Remy had gone to bed, leaving them to plot the coordinates on a world map. Of the 169 locations in Blaylock's grid, 82 of them were null, Pete now explained. Of the remaining 87, 53 were located in the middle of the ocean, which left us 34 latitude and longitude points that matched up with land. That's what you see plotted here. The coordinates were marked by red pushpins connected by white string. In rough, the pins formed a giant inverted V that started near Madagascar, peaked 2,800 miles to the northeast at Sri Lanka, and ended off the central coast of Sumatra, 1,400 miles to the southeast. "Where are the other pins?" Sam asked. Selma replied, "We pulled some out, most of them well inland. We wanted you to see this particular pattern first." Both Remy and Sam recognized the gleam in their Selma's eyes. During the night, she, Pete, and Wendy had discovered something significant. "Go on," Remy prompted. "After you got back from Madagascar and proposed the east-to-west Aztec migration theory, I started doing a little digging. In recent years, a number of archaeologists and anthropologists have been finding more and more evidence that the Malagasy people of Madagascar arrived there in the 1st or 2nd century, having sailed there from Indonesia, specifically the island of Sulawesi. I came across a map of the route the Malagasy were believed to have taken." Selma picked up the remote and powered up the TV across the room. The route, depicted as a red line on a map of the Indian Ocean, from the east coast of Africa to the Indonesian archipelago, was nearly identical to the one on the workroom's wall. "Incredible," was all Sam could say. "So Blaylock beat present-day experts to this theory by 120 or so years," Remy said. "That's impressive, but I don't..." "There's more," Selma said. Pete and Wendy got up on step stools, removed the pushpins, peeled back the tape, and pulled away the map. Beneath it was a second map, this one spanning from the east coast of Africa to South America. Like the first map, this one was covered in red pushpins connected by white string. "These are all Blaylocks?" Sam asked. "Yes." The pushpins began near the coastal city of Lumbo in Mozambique and proceeded across the waste of Africa to the west coast of Angola, before island-hopping first up the coastline, then west across the Atlantic to the easternmost bulge of Brazil, where they turned north and followed the coast of South America past Trinidad and Tobago and into the Caribbean Sea. Remy asked, "Are we to believe Blaylock visited all these places?" Sam replied, "He captured the Shenandoah in 1872, then went treasure hunting for his jeweled bird. Who knows how long he was at sea? It could have been decades, for all we know." "This looks familiar," Remy said. "Pete, Wendy, put the first map up beside this one, please." They did as she asked. Remy stared at this configuration for almost a full minute before smiling faintly. "Do you see it?" she asked. "See what?" asked Sam. In answer, Remy walked to one of the workstations. "Wendy's been teaching me a little Photoshop. Let's see how good a learner I am. Everybody go sit down. This might take me a few minutes." With her upper body blocking the computer monitor, no one could see what she was doing. At the work table, Sam leaned sideways on his stool, trying to get a peek. "Forget it, Fargo," Remy muttered. "Sorry." 20 minutes later, Remy turned in her seat and addressed the group. "Okay. We all remember the Orizaga Codex." Everyone nodded. "Remember the symbol spanning the upper half?" More nods. "Turn on the TV, Selma." "I'll be damned," said Sam. "We were staring at it the whole time. It wouldn't win any cartography awards, but all the big pieces are there. Remind me, when did the Malagasy arrive in Madagascar? First or second century? And when did the Aztecs first emerge in Mexico? Sixth century. The Malagasy blazed the first trail from Sulawesi. Then, a few centuries later, a bigger armada, 100 ships, if the Orizaga Codex is accurate, arrives in Madagascar, but they don't stop there. They keep heading west until they find Mexico. The journey must have taken years, Pete said. The walk across Africa alone would have lasted 6 months or more. If you figure conservatively 8 people to an outrigger, we're talking about as many as 800 people. Sam said it before. An exodus, Remy replied. How do we know they didn't go around Africa's southern tip? Asked Wendy. 2 reasons, Remy said. First, you'll notice that area doesn't appear on their map. Second, they may have tried it, but I can't imagine anybody getting around the Cape of Good Hope in outriggers. Those are some of the most unforgiving waters on Earth, Sam agreed. Here's the million-dollar question. On your map, where exactly does the big question mark fall? You've got me. Indonesia's a big place. For Blaylock, it was probably where he thought he'd find his treasure. For the Aztecs, it was Chicamostoc. When King Quautemozin dictated the Codex to Orizaga, he was trying to show where his forefathers came from. But after centuries of having the story handed down through one generation of royalty to the next, Quautemozin himself couldn't be more specific. Pete said, What I want to know is, why they left in the first place? That question was at least partially answered 2 hours later when Remy's old professor, Stan Didell, called Selma and requested a video conference. The group gathered around the TV in the workroom. Didell's smiling face appeared on the screen. In appearance, he was the exact opposite of George Millhaupt. Tall, thin, with a full head of salt-and-pepper hair. Good morning, Remy. Nice to see you again. And you, Professor. And that man beside you would be Sam. Nice to meet you, Professor. Sam introduced Pete and Wendy. Didell nodded in greeting. My secretary is helping me with all this. You don't mind, do you? I think technology has outpaced me a bit.
Not at all, said Remy.
I imagine you're anxious to talk about your find, so I'll get right to it. First, let's talk about the photos you sent. The vessel itself isn't unique. Canoe-shaped, 2 outriggers, and a single mast. The size is impressive, however. Next, I'm probably not telling you anything you haven't already worked out for yourself, but the carving on the bowsprit looks remarkably like Quetzalcoatl, the great plumed serpent god of the Aztecs.
Our guess as well.
We've talked about Quetzalcoatl, Sam said, but what's the significance? As in most Aztec myth systems, Quetzalcoatl plays an array of roles that depend on the period and the circumstances. In some cases, Quetzalcoatl was related to the wind, the planet Venus, arts, and knowledge. He was also the patron god of the Aztec priesthood. He was also believed to be responsible for the separation of the earth and sky, and an essential player in the creation of mankind.
That's a lot of hats to wear, Sam remarked.
And what about the other carving, the one on the stern? Clearly it's a bird of some kind, but I don't recognize it. As for this parchment you have, it's a copy of the Orizaga Codex, but I'm guessing you already knew that too.
Yes, said Remy.
Do you also know you may have the only known copy in existence?
No, we didn't.
In fact, until now, it was believed there were no copies, just the original. Here's the short story. Javier Orizaga, Society of Jesus, was said to have arrived in Mexico as part of Cortez's landing force. He carried with him a whole bevy of monks and such, presumably to help convert the savages. A few months after Orizaga penned his codex, he was ordered home by the powers that be.
When he got back to Spain, his codex was confiscated by the church. Orizaga was jailed and interrogated for 2 years, then released, having been denounced by the church and the state. He left Spain and traveled to what is present-day Indonesia, where he remained until his death in 1556. Indonesia again, Sam murmured. Professor, do we know where exactly in Indonesia?
I'm not sure. I can check for you.
This codex you have, Remy, where did you find it?
In Africa.
Interesting. If it's genuine, it's an incredible find. Have you had it physically examined?
Not yet.
You'll have to do that eventually. For now, let's assume it's genuine. There are a number of things about it that are not just remarkable, but potentially groundbreaking. Sam said, "You mean that it was dictated to Orizaga by the last king of the Aztecs?"
That and more. I have to admit, the upper part has me stumped. As for the lower part, here's what strikes me. The scene in the middle of the parchment clearly depicts a sea voyage of a great number of vessels. On the lower left side of the parchment is, I think, a depiction of the Aztecs' arrival in the area that would become their capital city of Tenochtitlan.
Seeing their stunned expressions, Didal chuckled and went on. Let me refresh your quintessential Aztec imagery. Legend has it that the Aztecs knew they'd found their homeland when they came across an eagle perched atop a cactus while eating a snake. The image on your codex is depicting essentially the same thing. The bird is different, and the flora is different, and there's no snake, but the theme is present.
Why wouldn't it be identical? Asked Sam.
My guess, it's a case of what I like to call MDI, migrational displacement iconography. It's a theory I've been toying with for some time. Essentially, it's this. As ancient peoples migrated, they tended to change their myths and imagery to suit their new geography. It's quite common, actually. If these old-world Aztecs, for lack of a better term, arrived in Mexico 9 centuries before the Aztec Empire rose, it's perfectly reasonable to think their original iconography would have changed drastically, not to mention their appearance as they interbred with the locals.
Sam and Remy looked at one another. Sam said, I can buy that.
Well, that's good, because that was the easy part, Didal said. The image in the lower right-hand corner, the one clearly meant to represent Chicamoztoc, is where the real wow factor is. How closely did you examine the image, Remy?
Not very, she admitted.
Well, there are a number of differences between the traditional depiction of Chicamoztoc and the one you have. First of all, there's no high priest at the entrance, and the faces you usually find clustered in each of the 7 caverns are missing.
I can't believe I missed that.
Don't be hard on yourself. In class, we barely touched on Chicamoztoc. That aside, it is what's in the center of the cavern I find so fascinating. I took the liberty of enlarging the scan you sent me.
Didal looked off camera and said, Gloria, would you mind?
Okay, good, thanks.
He faced the camera again.
This image is enlarged 400%. Gloria says it should be on your screen now. Do you have it? Didal asked.
We have it, replied Sam.
The first thing you'll probably notice is the creature between the 2 male figures in the middle of the cavern. The placement suggests it is a focus of reference. The lower half of the creature appears to be Quetzalcoatl. The upper half, though, is hard to make out. It could be the tail or something else altogether.
Sam said, one of the figures is standing, the other kneeling. That has to mean something.
Indeed, it suggests supplication. Also, did you notice that the figure on the right is holding something?
It's the Nahuatl symbol for flint, Remy said.
Right you are.
Normally I would classify this scene as a sacrificial ceremony of some kind, but you have to remember that the Aztecs were highly metaphorical in their written language. Flint can also represent separation and the breaking of old ties. Now, here's the kicker. In traditional drawings of Chicamoztoc, you'll find two sets of footprints, one set going into the cave and one set going out. In your drawing, there is only one set. And they're going out, Sam said. When you combine all of this, the supplicant figure, Quetzalcoatl, the flint, the footprints, you get what I believe is a ceremony of exile. The figure on the left, along with all of his followers, was banished. Based on the rest of the codex, they left Chicamoztoc, boarded their armada, headed west, and ended up in Mexico to become what history considers the Aztec people. Remy asked, Professor, do we know what became of Orizaga's original codex? Did the church destroy it, or is it tucked away in some archive somewhere? Neither, but I'm sure they'd intended that it never see the light of day. In 1992, the church held an auction of old but generally mundane artifacts, letters, illustrations, etc. Apparently, someone messed up and the Orizaga Codex was included in the lot. It was purchased by a Mexican millionaire, I believe. A coffee magnate. What was his name? Asked Sam. Didel hesitated, thinking. Garza? Alfonso or Armando? I can't remember which. They talked with Didel for a few more minutes, then disconnected. As they often were, Sam and Remy were on the same wavelength. Almost in unison, they said to Wendy, Do you think you can do something to clean up the... I know. The Quetzalcoatl image. I'm on it. Next, Sam and Remy turned to Selma, but she was a step ahead of them, already seated at her computer, typing. Got it. Alfonso Garza, father of Cristian Garza. Currently known as Cuautli Garza, president of Mexico and leader of the Mexica Tenochca party. Sam and Remy shared a smile. That's where it all started, he said. Just like Blaylock, Garza got a hold of the codex and caught the bug. It consumed him. Remy nodded. And took him somewhere he didn't expect. 30 minutes later, Wendy was done. I had to do some creative connect the dots, but I think I've got a fair representation of what it would have looked like originally. There's a familiar face, Sam said. Remy nodded. Blaylock's bird. The day ended with a phone call that Sam and Remy, in their exhaustion, had forgotten they were expecting. Selma answered, listened for a few moments, then hung up and walked to her workstation. A minute later, the laser printer started whirring. She walked back to the table with a sheaf of papers. The lab report on the samples you took from the outrigger. Do the honors, said Sam. Selma scanned the sheets, then said, The wood is from a durian tree, native to Borneo, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Score another point for Indonesia, Sam said. There seems to be a trend developing. The resin you scraped from the hull consisted of the sap from a subspecies of rubber tree, also found in Indonesia. Finally, the material you scooped from inside the hull, they found traces of pandan leaf, rattan, and gibang palm. Let me guess, Remy said. All materials used in the construction of natural sailcloth. Selma nodded. And all native to Indonesia, Sam added. You're betting 1,000, replied Selma. Shall I book your flights now, or wait until the morning?